Welcome to the third episode of They Shoot Actors, Don't They? Hey, everybody. I'm Aaron, and I'm here with...
Kat.
Jeff.
And today we're doing a report on a whole bunch of hot doc stuff, I think, for the most part. Hot docs is in mid-swing right now, and I think we've all seen a bunch of junk. a bunch of things, not a bunch of junk. First movie we're going to talk about is Best Worst Movie, which is a doc about kind of the cult surrounding Troll 2, which is has recently been regarded as the worst movie of all time. Kind of, you know, the new Plan 9 from Outer Space. And it was made by the child star of Troll 2 and mostly follows around him and the guy that played his father in Troll 2 as they go to a bunch of rep screenings of Troll 2, go to some conferences, and kind of find out about the cult of this film. So what did you think of this one, Kat?
Well, I kind of went in to the movie thinking that it would be funny and a good midnight screening, probably something really fun to see with a crowd. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen Troll 2, and so I didn't know how much I would actually get engaged in the story because I was in no way part of the cult following of the original bad film. But I ended up loving it. I thought it was really, really good. Like, in some ways better than it had any right to be, based on what I expected from the subject matter. I kind of thought, like, yes, Troll 2 is funny, and yes, there is a cult following, but it's still a relatively small phenomenon in the grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know if they would, like, how they would sort of treat the fact that this is actually still sort of like a weird, really, really small niche thing. But I thought that they handled it really well. I thought that it was put into perspective and into, you know, some kind of context that made sense. And the characters, the stars of Troll 2 and the director of Troll 2 and the people that they interview and that they track down and who sort of go on this little road trip of screenings with them are all really compelling and funny and interesting people. And the guy who played the dad in Troll 2 who... was so weird and interesting that I feel like he could have been talking about anything for 90 minutes and I probably would have enjoyed watching that.
Yeah, so much of the success of this film is pinned to that guy being so funny and charming.
Yeah,
I can't remember his... Do you remember his name?
George Hardy.
George Hardy.
I had my notes. but yeah, in the introduction of the film, or the first 10 minutes or so of the film, mm-hmm. it mostly focuses just on George Hardy.
On him being the funniest guy you'd ever want to know.
And yeah. It started to go off into Troll 2 territory, and I felt, oh, I wish this movie wasn't even about Troll 2, because this guy is the best.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does go back. He's probably 70% of the focus of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it totally makes it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if the director hadn't only got the idea to make the documentary
after talking with him.
And yeah,
I think that's the case. But it's interesting in this, and they kind of cop to it at the screening that we saw in the Q&A afterwards, is that these guys are responsible for creating this cult of Troll 2, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they organized a bunch of the screenings. There wasn't really much of... I mean, they had a bit of an internet buzz before this, but the whole thing about Troll 2 being this amazing buried treasure, the best first movie, it's kind of all bullshit.
Yeah, like, it had started off... They were starting off on little screening parties, and they would go to this office where they had 20 people, maybe, and they're like, it's our fourth annual, it keeps growing every year.
Yeah, and it's like this, the tiny room in an office.
But it has picked up pace, and just through, I guess, effective marketing, and the fact that George Hardy and the director, should have written his name down, have been touring with the film,
mm-hmm.
and just how enjoyable the Q&As are as well.
Yeah.
People have been telling their friends, and it has been growing to the point where it's screening here at the Bloor, mm-hmm. and screening again soon. But it did really, really well.
I'm sure the next one will be sold out.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. I mean, especially after Best Worst Movie did it as well as it did at Hot Docs. Like the screening,
Everyone's
the midnight screening was really, you know, full and really well received. And I heard that the second screening, they got a standing ovation from the audience. And that wasn't even the midnight crowd. That was just, you know, people at 2 p.m. who were that psyched about Best Worst Movie. So yeah. I think, yeah, probably the success of the inadvertent success of Troll 2 is going to sort of follow the, cause the documentary is really amazing. And it's totally like, the kind of doc that could have gone terribly wrong.
Yeah.
And then was just put together and edited and directed so well, and the people were so funny and interesting to watch that it ended up being one of the most enjoyable docs that I saw this year at Hot Docs.
I was not expecting it to look as good as it does, too. Like, it's done in a really professional style, and I kind of thought it would be a junky little DIY kind of project, but it's a great looking, you know, it's the kind of thing that you would expect to see in a theater getting a real run. It's a great looking and really well put together movie.
Yeah, it's the only film that I've seen so far that I've thought was exceptional or that I enjoyed all the way through. So,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And, oh yeah, I guess it's worth mentioning that it's not too much of a spoiler. With the film having this reputation as the worst movie ever made,
mm-hmm.
it's directed by an Italian who lives in Italy and who doesn't speak English very well. So the script was sort of weird in his direction of the performances in the film Troll 2 have all these weird nuances that are part of what's laughable and enjoyable as a bad movie. And they go to Italy to find out what the director thinks of the film. And he thinks it's a great movie.
there are some kind of hard scenes to watch in it with him where he really fights with this idea of, throughout the film, it seems like there's even scenes on the same day where he'll go from being like, how dare you think of my masterpiece like this, to accepting it, being this like terrible B movie that people just love. And he seems to fight with it a lot, but there's a lot of really funny material with him.
It's funny how he's the only person in the film about this film who thinks it's a good movie, but yet he ends up sort of being the bad guy in a way.
Yeah.
The good guys are the people who think this movie is terrible.
Yeah.
So this movie that the documentary is being reverent towards, it's only if you think it's a bad movie.
Yeah, but you like it anyway.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, when they show the stuff like, there's scenes where they have the screening at the Upright Citizens Brigade, where they're all making fun of it and have the Q&A afterwards. And that screening looks like a ton of fun. You know, I can see how a lot of how people want to be involved in this kind of cult, but it's not, you know, it's not a really remarkable film. There are 1,000 movies like Troll 2 out there that are fractured and weird and nonsense and cheap, and Troll 2's good in terms of one of those, but it was like, there were years of my life in high school and university where I exclusively watched movies like Troll 2, including Troll 2, and Troll 2 really didn't stick out in my mind until the last year that I've been hearing people mention it and hearing about these screenings and stuff like that. And I've just thought, really?
Yeah. I haven't seen it without an audience, and I don't feel that I'd be as into it without the audience. But when I saw it with a crowd, it was really fun and I enjoyed it. I don't know. You should go to the screening next week.
I think I might go check out the screening next week, because I think the crowd will be a lot of fun at it. I think it'll be a really good time.
I'm planning to. Now that I've seen the documentary, I think I'm for sure going to see the repeat screening, which is May 12th at the Bloor Cinema, I think.
Cat's going from Troll 2 to Cannes.
That's true. I get on a plane the following day with Troll 2 still fresh in my mind.
Perfect segue. You'd be talking everyone's ear off at Cannes about Troll 2.
But I saw this Italian masterpiece.
Have you guys seen anything else at Hot Docs that's been really good?
The one that I saw the other day that I actually really liked was Black Wave, The Legacy of the Exxon Valdez.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just, it was long and it was very depressing, but it was really well made, and it was shocking to find. It was like one of those, you know, documentaries where you watch it in order to find out horrible facts about the world you live in. And, you know, it's not an enjoyable film to watch, but it was really amazing. And it was shocking to find out the extent to which that region of Alaska is still affected really, really significantly by that oil spill, which happened 20 years ago. I remember being like 11 years old and seeing it on the news at the time. It's kind of a vivid memory of early awareness of news as a, you know, like big deal news events kind of thing. I remember that. And I remember, I don't know, Princess Diana dying or something like that. Right. But, there's still thousands of gallons of oil on those beaches and, like over a dozen people in this tiny community have committed suicide in the aftermath because the ordeal of the trial with Exxon was so horrible. Which is, you know, a dozen people is like, for a community of that size, it would be as though 10,000 people in Toronto committed suicide. Like, it's an insane percentage of the population. And, and there's still, you know, almost everyone in the community is filing for bankruptcy because the fish still haven't come back. The salmon have only just started coming back, and it was a fishing community in the first place.
Yeah.
Something like 15 out of the 20 species of wildlife that were affected never came back at all.
Wow.
Just astonishing stuff. And Exxon tied up the settlement that was awarded to the people in the area was $5 billion. They tied that up in appeals until 2008 and got it reduced to $500 million, which per person is not enough to pay most of their bankruptcy costs.
Yeah.
So the whole story is pretty depressing, but the doc is very, very good, very well put together, and interviews locals, but also just happens to be this woman who is a marine biologist and a oil spill expert who lives in the region, who's been living there since before the spill happened.
The filmmaker is?
No, just one of the main sort of people that were interviewed in the film. And she's really, really knowledgeable. And so in addition to the sort of personal stories of the fishermen and, you know, people who just live there, there's also this woman who happens to live there, but is also an expert on exactly this kind of thing. So yeah, it was really a very informative and really, but very much a downer. Like not a fun movie. I totally cried like 3 times during it.
You also saw, you quite liked Art and Copy too, didn't you?
I did. And actually the Art and Copy, I saw Art and Copy and I saw Objectified, which was, which is directed by the guy who made Helvetica a couple of years ago. And I saw them sort of 2 consecutive days and they kind of are, connected in my mind because Objectified is about industrial design. Art and Copy is about advertising.
And kind of like Hallmark advertising from the 60s and 70s and 80s when creative types were taking over, right?
Exactly. So it's sort of the revolution in advertising that, you know, came out with huge iconic ads that we all kind of know about and the people who sort of started them and still work in advertising today. And it was really cool to see, you know, like I remember in a class in university learning about the Lyndon Johnson campaign ad, the Daisy ad, where it's a little girl and then it focuses in on her eye and in the pupil you see the atomic bomb go off and it's this like
the ad that only aired once and turned the election.
Exactly, right? So I'd read about that ad. I'd never seen it in full before, so it was really cool to see that. And you know, the Apple 1984 ad, and you get to meet the people who came up with Got Milk and Just
that
Do
was,
It.
That
and
was really cool. The whole milk section was great with that
really
guy.
Really interesting.
They kept getting back to the idea of getting at truths in advertising, and the Got Milk guy, the guys that came up with that, one of them says that the ad campaign prior to that was Milk Does a Body Good, where they'd show somebody, you know, running a 100-yard dash and then chugging a glass of milk at the end, and he said, nobody does that. You don't chug a glass of milk after you've run. You know, the truth of milk is
you get it.
Eating. It was like you buy it anyways, and when you're, you know, you go make yourself a bowl of cereal, and then you go to pour some milk out, and there's only a little bit left. You know, that's the truth of milk.
Exactly.
So they built it, the campaign all around that, of just like
always make sure you have an extra carton because sometimes you run out and you want a cookie.
Were there any Michael Bay interviews?
There were not.
That would have been funny.
I don't care about this movie.
But I really enjoyed it. I liked, you know, and it was like the people who came up with the Nike Just Do It mm-hmm. campaign. The Got Milk story was really interesting, I thought. You know, the Apple ad campaigns, yeah. all of that kind of stuff.
And the Apple, the guys that came up with the 1984 campaign are also the people that did the Think Different campaign and the Dancing Silhouette iPods ads. Like, yeah, the people that are responsible for every iconic step right. of Apple, which yeah. is pretty amazing.
Pretty astonishing, yeah. But I mean, it's obviously been working for them. Like, that's a partnership that's been very effective for many years. So it was, and it, you know, it's also fascinating to look at ads like that that are so amazing and so have such an impact, and then realize the number of steps that it takes before that kind of ad is approved, and how much of a struggle it is for them, and how many ideas get shot down by clients who don't understand why you would want to market their product that way when it's not really talking about the product or whatever, and like the frustrations that they go through. It was really fascinating. But I kind of connected that film in my mind to Helvetica, which was not at all about a similar kind of thing. It was about font designers, but it was similar in the sense that they're really, really compelling characters who you otherwise don't get a chance to personally experience. Like, they're neat guys, and you see their work, and you're familiar with their work, but you don't know who they are, like the people behind the thing that you know, and they're all really eccentric and odd and funny and interesting, and it totally made the movie that all of those advertisers were really neat, funny, awesome dudes.
Yeah.
Much like with Helvetica, if those guys had been boring, that wouldn't have been nearly as effective a film. And I was hoping to see more of that in the next film by the guy who made Helvetica, which was not Art and Copy. Yeah. It was objectified, and I was kind of disappointed in it, actually. I thought that, I don't know, maybe industrial designers aren't as compelling, but there were nowhere near enough moments in that film where I was like, wow, that guy made that thing that we all know and use and enjoy. It was kind of abstract and didn't really connect it to real things.
Yeah, everyone's been saying that about Objectified. I've heard a lot of people being really disappointed in it that loved Helvetica. But yeah, I think pointing those people to Art and Copy is more worthwhile, because they are really good companion pieces and do have a lot of the same feel to them, I think.
Yeah.
So we're just going to do a quick rundown of... Just going to do some blasts. Some quick blasts
quick
of
blasts.
Other stuff we've seen in Hot
so
Dogs.
Sit down.
So buckle up! what have you seen quickly that you want to mention? What else at Hot Dogs?
I saw Hard Name, the new Alan Wang film.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was good, but too many subjects, and he got sort of so wrapped up in the people that he didn't deal with the social programs that help these ex-cons sort of get back into society.
Mm.
It's understandable, because they're fascinating characters, but there's like 6 or 7 of them, and that over a 90-minute film is a lot to sort of juggle.
Cat, go!
One thing I saw that I sort of liked was Rembrandt's J'accuse, the new...
Oh, the new Peter Greenaway.
Yeah. It was it was hilarious, because Peter Greenaway's disembodied head is in the center of the screen for about 90% of the film, narrating at you.
Fucking hate that guy.
It was really funny. He doesn't distinguish between fact and his own theories at all. But the whole film is trying to solve the mystery of Rembrandt's Night Watch, which is his most famous painting, through 30 clues that Peter Greenaway has identified within the painting, which includes all of the characters as well as some other, you know, aspects of the painting. Oh. And he employs the entire cast of his 2007 film Night Watching to play the people from the painting so that he can question them sort of courtroom style.
Oh my god.
The whole thing was so preposterous that I have to say it was enjoyable, but it was ludicrous at the same time.
That even sounds like worse than I would have imagined.
Sounds kind of amazing to me.
Exactly. Oh. It was the best worst movie that I saw, actually.
I get your best worst movie right here, Troll 2. It's every Peter Greenaway movie. What else have you caught besides that?
I saw one that I kind of liked called Ghost Bird, which is about the ivory-billed woodpecker, a species of woodpecker that's thought to be extinct for, since the 1920s.
It's the holy grail of bird-watching
birds.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Tell us more.
Look, man, some people enjoy birding. It's
tell them when Peter Greenaway's made a bird documentary.
It was about a sighting of the bird that happened a few years ago, which then led to this huge, crazy sequence of events where it was sort of publicly announced that the bird, you know, had been sighted and wasn't extinct, and there was a ton of government money put into programs to essentially find the bird. Mm-hmm. But, like, really, money that could have otherwise been used to help other species not become extinct. Yeah. And they never found any proof that the bird was there, but this tiny little community in, I don't even remember the state, I think it was in Arkansas, mm-hmm. That was near the sort of swampland where the bird was sighted, all of a sudden everything was like, the ivory-billed haircut, the woodpecker special burger, whatever. It's like, they're expecting this huge influx of tourism and all uh-huh. of this stuff, and it's like, nobody ever actually proved that the bird was still alive. So that was a pretty entertaining documentary, I have to say.
Oh, Arkansas.
Another film that I really, really liked is Brock Enright, The Good Times Will Never Be the Same, which is a documentary shot in a verite style.
And looks gorgeous. It looks gorgeous. One of the nicest looking docs you will ever see.
And it's all lockdown, tripod stuff, so much so that, and because of how unaware of the cameras or seemingly unaware of the cameras and subjects are, you almost don't believe it's a documentary for a while, but it's gorgeous. And I'm not interested in Brock Enright's performance art at all.
Well, it's about him,
his creation of his first solo show.
Yeah. And the camera follows him across the country with his girlfriend as they try to cobble together material for the show.
They go to his girlfriend's parents' cottage or cabin, mm-hmm. Just so he can be away from everything to put together the show. And it's a fascinating film, even though I'm not interested in the art that he made at all. And it's directed and shot by the cinematographer of Wild Combination, the Arthur Russell documentary from last year.
Oh, okay.
I really liked it. So.
I liked Prom Night in Mississippi.
I think I'm going to see that tomorrow. That one looks really good.
Yeah, it was great. And it's about a high school, the only high school in Charleston, Mississippi, which, even though the school has been integrated since, not since that, you know, what became a law in the United States, but mm-hmm. since the 70s, let's say.
Yeah. Integrated a little bit late.
A little late, but,
look,
you know.
They did it. It's all right.
They've never had a integrated prom at the school because the parents and teachers, I guess, are
racist.
Yeah. Yeah. Have a long legacy of bigotry.
Very long legacy of racism. And so apparently since like 1997, Morgan Freeman, who, that's his hometown, who, you know, has money and is a well-known personality, has been offering the local school board that he would pay for the prom if they held an integrated prom. And it took them until 2008 to finally accept his terms, I guess.
Yeah.
So the whole movie is about the planning of this first ever integrated prom, and it's mostly interviews with the students and a few interviews here and there with their parents. And it's the students are amazing because they're very simple understanding of the fact that this level of racism is ludicrous is so refreshing. Like they're so honest about it, and they're so honest about the fact that there's nothing they can do to change their family's point of view, which they consider to be really unreasonable. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's like a white parent group in the town that decides to hold their own separate prom anyway because they, you know, don't want their kids to go to the integrated prom. And there's all kinds of things that sort of come up over the course of the documentary, but it's mostly compelling because the kids are so awesome. Mm-hmm. And the amount of struggling that they have to do it just in order to do normal things like hang out with their friends if their friends happen to be black is astonishing. Like, it's astonishing to see that that's the case in the present day. Plus, there seems to be only one interracial couple in the entire school, and they are super adorable. They love each other very much, and her dad is... she's white, and he's black, and her dad is racist, and doesn't agree with what she's doing, but, you know, struggles to accept her as a human being anyway, and it's the pathos of that kind of relationship, and, you know, their plans to sort of, you know, stay together and get married one day and whatever. It's all very, it's very sweet. It's a very sweet documentary.
And Morgan Freeman is her boyfriend, right?
Yeah. Spoiler alert. The boyfriend is Morgan Freeman.
Okay, since our last podcast, the lineup for Cannes has been announced, and it's insane.
It is. Like, yeah, it is really crazy. It's like the year gonzo foreign cult film directors take over Cannes.
Yeah, it's crazy. There's a lot of stuff in there. There's not a lot of films at that festival. Like, right. It's a pretty small selection. So for that many of them to be seemingly amazing is pretty shocking.
Well, yeah, run down.
There's a new Bong Joon-ho film, a new Chan Wook Park film, the new Tarantino, the new Johnny To, new Gaspar Noé, new Hirokazu Koreeda, Lars von Trier, but, like, Koreeda just made Still Walking last year.
Yeah.
And he's...
Already got a new one,
which is exciting. It's about an inflatable doll maid, which it's not going to be one of his best, I'm sure.
But still.
I'm still excited about it. Tsai Ming-liang has a new film, which, from the stills that have been released, looks ridiculous.
Absolutely insane.
Looks as sort of lush as The Wayward Cloud, but with a bunch of French actors and actresses.
Yeah, icons of French cinema.
Yeah.
Like a completely crazy,
wow.
Like... Yeah.
It's an insane, like, there's going to be a ton of crazy neo-horror movies competing against each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen the trailer for Antichrist. I haven't seen trailers for anything else that's playing. I don't even know if there are trailers for anything else that's
Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah, Inglorious Bastards.
There's a trailer for Vengeance, the new Johnny To film with Johnny Halliday.
That trailer is really thin, though.
I'm
excited for it, too, but that trailer looks like it could be for any Johnny To film. Like,
yeah.
It's like 30 seconds long or something. Yeah.
There's also a new Ken Loach, which looks actually pretty hilarious.
Oh, is it in competition?
I can't remember. I think it is.
His last one wasn't great. I quite liked it, but it didn't really make a ripple. It was... what was the name of it?
Time in the City?
No, it...
was after The Wind That Shakes the Barley?
Yeah, it was the one after Wind That Shakes the Barley, and it was about a woman who starts some... basically, who runs an employment agency and starts hiring illegal Eastern European immigrant labor and paying them nothing so that she can kind of break even. She's like a struggling young mother and starts working with illegal immigrants to get a leg up. It was good, not great, but I saw it last year actually, it might have even been the year before at TIFF.
Okay.
And it kind of vanished. But yeah, I'm always excited to see new stuff by him. Even if it's not great, it's usually solid.
Yeah.
Still never seen a Ken Loach film.
Really?
Never?
No.
You should.
Sweet 16. That's why I just said, was it the new Terrence Davies movie?
You should see Sweet 16 and Wind That Shakes the Barley are unbelievable.
Okay.
But they are fucking downers. That guy specializes in underclass downer cinema.
Yeah.
But good stuff.
But he's so great at downers. Like, I never feel like his films are manipulative tearjerkers. They're never, like, sappy, maudlin sort of, like, melodramas. They're always just, like, here's reality.
You're so real.
You will weep.
Yeah.
You will weep a lot at this reality.
Yeah.
But yeah, really good.
Segue, I nearly wept when I found out the other day that Shinya Sugimoto has made a new Tetsuo film.
Boo! Yeah, that I just saw a couple stills from that, and it looks awesome. And the Tetsuo movies rule.
I thought you were booing Tetsuo, and I was weird. I know. I realized you booed my segue, and that hurts. It was all done in good fun. I'm trying to entertain the people.
I'm sure they'll appreciate it.
Leave a comment if you appreciated that segue. And if Aaron is wrong. But yeah, he had sent out a casting notice, and people thought that he was working on some film called The Bullet Man. And they had searched for a star who was half Asian, half Caucasian, and who could speak English. And it was just announced the other day that this film that he shot and is now editing already was a new English language Tetsuo film.
Wow. Is it set in the States?
Or? I'm not sure. There's been talk for like 5 or more years about him making Tetsuo in America.
Wow.
So maybe that's what it is.
That is crazy.
That is crazy.
I'm excited for it.
It's very exciting.
I
wonder.
Loved the first two.
I
even remember when Tetsuo, when the second one came out,
yeah.
After seeing the first one, I was like, but like the world ends at the end of the first one, and with the second one too, it's like, but the end of the second movie is the apocalypse. So I wonder what he's gonna do. Probably with the second one, didn't just ignore the end of the first one.
Yeah, probably.
And do it as basically an unrelated story. Yeah. That's exciting though. Do you know when that's coming out?
No, they're editing it now, and I think at the Cannes market they're gonna have promos.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Wow. Well, I imagine that with a film like that, there's probably a lot of post-production type stuff to do, but maybe not.
Hopefully
I mean,
not too much.
Well, tons of
Tsukamoto's pretty good with, like, in-camera effects.
Yeah, the first Tetsuo were, like, almost all mechanical effects, aside from some, like, scenery CGI stuff, I think.
I really hope that it's mostly mechanical effects.
So
that would
be out soon.
That would be amazing, yeah.
Fox today came out with a press release about the Wolverine movie.
Yeah, it didn't make enough money.
Yeah, they're complaining about the amount of money it made. We talked about this in our first podcast about them whining about the downloads of the leak and how we thought it wouldn't make any difference, it wouldn't make a dent in it, whether or not people had seen it. And it didn't make a dent in it, because that movie made $86 or $87 million its opening weekend. More money than the other top 5 films made that weekend, but Fox is still complaining about the number of downloads. And they said they have now estimated, with their own number, is that 4 million people downloaded, well, not 4 million people, I guess there were 4 million downloads of the Wolverine work print, which is 4 times the other estimates of how many downloads there were that don't come from them. They're claiming that sites have been shut down because of it, and they're going to continue to shut down sites. But if anything, I would think that this is proof that downloading makes, especially when it comes to blockbusters, makes no difference in the grand scheme of things. You can't have a movie, a not very good movie, that makes $86 or $87 million its opening weekend, and then complain about people that have downloaded it the 2 weeks prior, I think.
Yeah. Did you guys know that the Directors Guild of America is sort of working in the Supreme Court, I think, right now, on ways to try and control downloading, and they're wanting special privileges towards tracking computers and whatnot.
Oh.
And the current president of the DGA right now is Steven Soderbergh. And he's like forwarding. He's like gung-ho. He's like saying, going how his smaller film, first it was like Ocean's 13 got downloaded so many times, mm-hmm. but then it hurts my smaller films even more. It's strange, like, when it's a smaller film, but he's also done things like Bubble was released day and date.
Simultaneously online and on video and in theaters. Yeah.
So I found that really surprising when he was trying these new things.
Yeah.
New release strategies. Like, and I think Che was video on demand day and date as well.
It was, yeah.
He's still like
pushing this anti-download agenda. It seems it's a waste of time and money. It's going to be there forever. It's like people look back on the record industry's home taping is killing music campaign from the early 80s as totally laughable, and it's the same thing now. It's, you can't put the dam back up. It's done. There's broadband everywhere. There's torrents everywhere. people are, it's not a business model that people are using. People are just uploading the stuff on their own and downloading it from those. It's like community efforts. And I would think, you know, the solution to this kind of thing is, I think, something Steven Soderbergh would get behind, is that you need to make downloads more available, high-quality downloads that are available to people at reasonable prices. And I think bootlegging has a lot more to do with that people are tired of paying $13 to see a shitty movie in a movie theater. Yep. You know, people downloaded Wolverine because they were curious about it and thought it might be absolute garbage.
Yeah.
And enough people liked it that they went to go see it in the movie theater.
Yeah. You know? Or they have 4 million people who might have been angry about having wasted. So that's just 4 million enemies they don't have to worry about.
Yeah. I'm keeping my pick of the week this week Hot Docs centric. We just talked about Prom Night in Mississippi, and I'm going to be seeing that right away. But it's screening, by the time this podcast is up, it's screening on the last Sunday of Hot Docs, which is May 10th. It's at the Royal at 1:30. So that one, I think, is a pretty safe bet. What are you going to be seeing this week, Kat?
Well, I'm actually going to try to see some more Hot Docs films as well this week, but my pick of the week for the people out there is for sure the new Star Trek. I got a chance to see a preview screening.
Harry Knowles over here got a free screening.
Yeah, Knowles got the invite.
I got the invite and I got to see it last night and I thought it was amazing. So I highly recommend it. For fans of Star Trek as well as non-fans of Star Trek, because it's a pretty decent action film, good special effects, really awesome set design, fun, even if you're not familiar with the whole elaborate history of Star Trek. But if you are a fan, I thought that the casting was amazing. I think the casting will probably please even the most hardcore fanatics. They really do... it's almost impossible to bring something new to a role that... to a character that everyone is 100% familiar with, that your entire audience knows and, you know, already knows all of their quirks, all of their characteristics. It's not like James Bond, who's been played by seven different guys. It's like, there's only ever been one Dr. McCoy. It's DeForest Kelly, and that's it. Like, he is that character. So to have someone new just waltz into that role, it's a challenge. And I think that the entire cast did a really amazing job.
My picks of the week at the Review Theater on Tuesday, which is the 12th, I think.
Yep.
They're screening a double feature of Black Caesar and Jaws. I don't know.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Two classics.
Together at last.
Yeah.
And where is the Review?
That Roncesvalles. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, those should be good. I didn't know about that double bill before. Not a big fan of the Review, though, I have to say.
I like it. I think it's a cool little theater.
It's a neat little theater.
And they're showing Jaws and Black Caesar.
So shut up. Fair enough. Well, that does it for the third episode of the They Shoot Actors, Don't They podcast. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. We'll be back in a couple weeks, and we'll see if we can't do something with Kat, who will be in Cannes. While we're supposed to do it.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to record myself and send it. Oh, I'm not sure if we'll be able to do, like, I could do a phone interview. Like a reporter who's, you know, on the battlefield.
I don't know, Lizzie, I hope that we can do, like, a live phone thing, but it sounds terrible, and we can't even understand Kat.
I'm trying to figure out the logistics of a phone interview. I don't know if it's going to be possible, but we'll see.
If not,
boy, how sweet would it be to get the scoop on the new Gaspar Noé movie?
For real. Well,
before the rest of the internet,
we can know how many, like, rape scenes there are.
I'll count the rapes.
I love that we all thought of the rape scene punchline at the same time. And on that note, see you guys in a couple weeks.
Bye.
Bye.